Hello and welcome to episode 48 of the Wilder podcast. In this pre-Christmas episode, we bring a story of hope. Tom Clark and Alex Brocklesby from the National Trust at Purbeck are catalysing a movement to connect a community to one of the most biodiverse landscapes in the UK. Hello, Tom.
Good evening, Chloe.
I feel a bit embarrassed.
No, don't. We can't. It's just boring to continue to apologise about the delay and tardiness in our episodes. People acknowledge this. No one gets upset if we don't do it. They know we're busy and there's lots of cool stuff happening. Don't be embarrassed.
Okay. That's a very fair point, but it has been 6 weeks.
Yeah. You know, you can't rush these things, Claire.
Yeah.
This episode, as you said with many of our episodes, but this episode is well worth the wait. I've just finished editing the interview itself, and it kind of just fills you with hope that there are people like Tom and Alex out there, super smart, super passionate, and really willing to attack the systemic challenges when it comes to Purbeck and the community. And it's definitely something to look forward to.
I think it touches on so many themes that we've explored on the podcast so far around kind of nature connection, around community creating movements. So there's something in here for everyone, I think.
Yeah, and it's also just nice to feel that we're not the only crazies in the room. That the fact that they're willing to attack these challenges on such a broad level, and not just a theoretical level. You know, here's my theory as to how we can solve these problems. They've just gone, no, theory's great, but actually let's practically apply this to a use case and risk failure. But I feel like we're digressing, and I feel like we're going off piece to our usual format of introducing ourselves in the podcast and what we're about.
And perhaps that shows how much we enjoyed the episode, that we've gone straight into the interview without giving any context about who we are and what we're doing here at the Grange Project. But you do it so well, Tom. Can you introduce the listeners to the Wilder podcast?
Yeah, I can do. But what I did recently was read the description for the podcast that we wrote right at the beginning. I feel it's a little bit out of date. It's very much like follow the family's journey as they go through their rewilding experience and talk to experts, which is true. You know, we are Chloe and Tom, husband and wife, rewilding the Grange Project here in Southeast Wales next to Monmouthshire. But I think the podcast has become much more than that description now. And maybe it's morphing and evolving as our awareness is evolving into something slightly more specific, but broad.
I mean, that sounds really clear, Tom.
Well, we want to address and understand those systemic challenges. So that's where we're moving towards, isn't it? It's trying to keep rewilding as kind of one of the focus, but there's so much more to it. You can't just fix rewilding and fix the world. It's around education, community, engagement, the economy, ecopreneurship. Like, there's so many more facets to this that if you try and attack one of them, that way lies madness, because you can't. They're all intermingled.
I think it probably reflects our passions and interests as well. Like, we're not ecologists by background. You know, we've come from very different sectors. I've come from clinical psychology. You've come from the military, and then kind of an entrepreneurial skill set mingling of various different experiences. And it's left us with a real interest and passion for nature. But really, it's connecting to actually what does nature contribute to the systemic challenges we're currently experiencing. And perhaps the focus of the podcast has gone from why is rewilding important and how do we rewild, to actually how do we help society move to a more sustainable future that includes a lot more wild nature, so that we can both experience the benefits of that and also offer our care to the ecosystem that is integral to both our well-being and the well-being of the planet.
Yeah, if you could just distill that down into like a paragraph so I can put it on the podcast description, then we're good. So everyone listening, it's clear as mud. That is exactly what this podcast is all about. I hope you enjoy it. But actually, to be fair, this interview is pretty much summarizes the purpose really of what we're trying to achieve. Do you want to go straight into that, or do you want to embarrass me before we go into it?
Let's tell the story of the sheep.
I don't want to talk about it.
Well, perhaps we should start with, I mean, the fact we might need to introduce the listeners to the fact we have sheep.
Mm. How long we got for that, Chloe? So we got offered the loan of 6 conservation sheep from our pig man Paul mentor, who also is now the pig sheep man Paul mentor.
It's true. And we do also have, the sheep are joined 2 resident pigs. They're currently on site doing some fantastic work when they're not escaping.
Yeah. And you know, me, I'm a little bit stubborn, and I like to learn by doing as opposed to being learned by told or learned by reading. So once we got offered some sheep, I was like, yeah, right. So have a look what effect they're going to have on the land.
And is it worth us to say a little bit about why sheep aren't typically used in rewilding contexts?
Yeah.
I mean, this is coming from my layperson's understanding of the role of sheep in an ecosystem. But essentially, my understanding is, first of all, sheep aren't native, which means they have a certain interaction with the ecosystem that has not evolved from them being a original species to the landscape. And secondly, most commercial sheep breeds tend to really eat, they kind of really mow the grass. So they go really nibble, really down low in a way that isn't very healthy for the production of grass and a load of other wildflowers, because they also preferably eat flowers that are coming through, which obviously then stunts the opportunity for those flowers to reseed and create a more diverse landscape. So essentially, if you have too many sheep in a field, it creates a kind of Bowling Green effect of very short grass without a lot of diversity in it.
Now, I think that's a good explanation. So why have we got sheep again?
because you're stubborn.
Yeah, I see.
But mostly because we have got a conservation breed of sheep, which are supposed to have a more browsing and grazing effect. So they're not just supposed to nibble the grass really down short. We have very low density of sheep. So we have 6 currently on the whole project.
Top and bottom of it is that we've got Castle Milk Moritz, which are particularly beautiful looking sheep, that if you're going to have sheep, they're the ones, I think. And our main effort for them is to basically just put them on bits of the project and see the effect they have, just to learn from it. You know, they are like an option because pigs and people don't always mix, as we've learned, and cows and people, ponies and people may not mix. Sheep, especially this breed, are known to be flighty.
More about that later.
Could be a good compromise, and that's what we're experimenting. Anyway, they arrived, they went straight into the orchard and started doing their thing, and that was wonderful. And we're like, yes, we are rewilders and sheep owners and or borrowers, and this is great. And then every day we went out, got some support to help us train them to the bucket, and eventually they would come to the bucket, not feed from the bucket, but come to the bucket, and we're like, yes, we've got this nailed. Then came the day we had to move them into the next field, and long story short, a few hours worth of 5 idiots running around this field trying to convince these sheep to get out of the field, which they won't follow the bucket. The door was wide open, but they couldn't see that gate for some reason and refused to go out. And there was no way we could get them out of this field. So a couple of days worth of thinking about it, quite a lot of stress, frustration. We then had to build this whole artificial fence line to then create a third field to then, which connected them between that and the new field, and then leave trails of sheep feed to convince them whatever they wanted, because they were going to do whatever they wanted, to eventually get into that field where we wanted them as the final kind of staging point for them. And if only that was the end of the story. Now, there will be people that are used to having sheep will know that cattle grids don't necessarily hold in livestock, which is weird because my time in the military, the British Army training areas have lots of sheep on, and their cattle grids that are, I assume, keep them from escaping, but not these sheep. Oh no, they get up to the cattle grid and then just leap about halfway across and then do this weird knees to chest thing with their legs, trying to break their own legs and get out the other side. So then they escaped numerous times. And then we've had to solve it by closing off all of those entrances with new gates. And now they are now happily ensconced in their new home. Ta-da!
I mean, I think the low point was a Sunday evening at about 4:30.
Oh no, don't talk about this bit.
Where Tom had spent about 2 hours shouting various expletives at these sheep, trying to persuade them back into their field. And then his bright idea, which I can see the logicals, was to use the Land Rover Discovery we have to try and block an entrance or kind of shepherd the sheep, if that's the right description. And then what happened to the car, Tom?
Got stuck.
It did get stuck. Luckily, our lovely farmer came to help us, but it wasn't our finest sheep borrowing moment.
No, it was when 3 kids were in the back of the Discovery, because I thought it'd be a fun activity for them to join us. And then we got stuck. And then it was the 3 young children saying, "Daddy, are we stuck? Are we stuck? We're stuck. Yay, we're stuck. Daddy's stuck. Daddy got the car stuck." And continuing that as we look at each other, Chloe, don't we? Kind of like, this is the last thing we need right now.
Yeah.
So anyway, Pig Sheep Man Paul, you've got a lot to answer for, and you can probably have the sheep back, to be honest.
Oh, I love the sheep though. They're in the field in front of the house at the moment, and you wake up in the morning, you see them, and they love to perch on the invertebrate mounds we've created, like some sort of like mountain sheep goat thing, like surveying their landscape. They're a really lovely addition, but yeah, we'll see.
As always, it's gone on a little bit longer than we'd expected, but I hope people enjoyed the dits from our time as pig sheep owners. Cool. Well, I think we've done a bit of introduction now, so I think there's nothing really left to say other than sit back, get a nice cup of tea or coffee, and really enjoy this conversation of people who are making some really positive changes to their local community.
Hello, Alex and Tom, and welcome to the Wilder Podcast.
Thank you, Chloe.
Hi, Chloe.
We're so delighted to be joined by you both, and you who both work for the National Trust at Purbeck. And whenever I see a LinkedIn post or an article connected to Purbeck, it feels like there's so much ambition in the approach, and I'm not alone in that. So I'm going to drop in a little quote from George Monbiot, who recently described the work that you're doing as an incredible initiative to reconnect local people to this amazing landscape. So congratulations for that. Good endorsement to set the tone of the conversation, and you're really looking forward to hearing more about that and what you're achieving across at Purbeck. So before we get started, I wonder if you could briefly introduce yourself for the listeners.
Yeah, certainly. Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Clarks. I'm the Senior Volunteering and Community Manager for the National Trust in Purbeck, and I've been working here for 7.5 years now.
And hi, everyone. I'm Alex Brocklesby. I work in Purbeck with Tom and have also been working in Purbeck for about 7.5 years, and I lead our Children and Young People work and some of our access work.
Wow. We've got the right people on the call. I was wondering, before we get any further, I'd like to know a little bit more about you guys. So what's inspired you to go work for the National Trust and also specifically within their community engagement area?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I grew up in London, and in common with a lot of people in London, you go and experience nature on holidays. Now, I was fortunate when I was 6 to come down to Purbeck. So that, I mean, this is quite a corny story, right? So age 6, a kid from the ghettos of leafy North London suburbs, coming down to Purbeck, and we stayed in a yoldy Purbeck cottage that was on West Street in Corfe Castle that was owned by a brother of a mate of my dad at work as a second home and rented out to his mates. And I was 6, and I can still remember now going out and seeing foxes on Corfe Common and walking the coast path. We went to Durlston Country Park and saw seabirds soaring over the cliffs and going past Old Harry Rocks and just going, wow, what is this? You know, that proper visceral connection and just wanting more of it. I was 6. I didn't have a strategy, but that was what set it on my path. Grew up in London. Importantly, had those nature experiences within London parks, and there was a good network through London Wildlife Trust and local groups where I could keep my interest in nature, and then did the whole kind of studying thing. Worked for 10 years for London Wildlife Trust, which was very fortunate to get into. And crucially, I wanted to be a ranger when I started. I wanted to practically bring nature recovery together. That was how I saw it. But in 2006, started to manage Camley Street Natural Park, which is like the granddaddy of nature conservation sites, created off a coal drop in King's Cross in the early 80s, bringing nature into the heart of a city, a very poor part of the city as it was then. And that transformed me. Managing that space transformed me. It wasn't about nature. We had some amazing small bits of nature, but the impact on everybody who came into that nature space was profound. And you know, it had impact on directors of global companies, as well as kids growing up in the local Somerstown estate who were experiencing being under the canopy of trees for the first time. And that impact of nature on everybody is so optimistic. And to experience that was, changed me. That was then my focus around people and nature. I moved down to Dorset in 2010 and have been doing this thing for 15 years in Dorset.
I also grew up in Southeast London until I was about 7, and I have a distinct memory of, you know, we lived in a flat, me and my brother and my mum and dad, and we had foxes that would come and visit in the garden, and we would feed them, and they had a set in the back of the garden, and they'd bring their cubs out, and we'd watch them play every year, every spring, and then we'd be feeding them and stroking them. I mean, that probably, you know, wouldn't have been the right thing to do, but my parents would have had no idea back then. But it's those kind of urban nature experiences that are really formative, and also had the privilege of my grandma living in Bournemouth. So we'd come and visit. That was our holidays, was coming to Bournemouth and having the beaches. You know, on a treat day, we'd go over to Purbeck and we'd go to Shell Bay and just enjoy being somewhere completely wild, and beaches had a big part to play. And then I was fortunate enough to move to Ghana in West Africa when I was 8. for a couple of years, and that massively solidified nature connection for me. You know, we were just had so much freedom. We'd be climbing mango trees with snakes. We'd be going in little rowing boats around lakes with crocodiles in. It was a completely different type of nature experience, but we were effectively living outside. And then coming back and living in the UK, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was growing up. I just knew that I enjoyed nature and understanding people's reaction and interaction with nature. And then saw David Attenborough's Planet Earth and thought, that looks incredible. I'd love to do that. So went into marine biology. But it was about 10 years ago, after I had my children, and I started working in a small community enterprise in North Bournemouth. And that was very much at the heart of a very tight-knit community in North Bournemouth. And I was working on a public health funded project. And it was just basically looking at how do you improve society? How do you try and improve people's lives? A place where the life expectancy was actually around 10 years less than the national average. And so it had just purely trying to improve people's lives through health, well-being, skills, jobs, that type of thing. And then when I moved to the National Trust, it was a combination of nature and community. How can we try and improve society through nature? And that's what me and Tom joined around about the same time. And we've been building a movement within Purbeck to try and make that happen.
It's always so interesting hearing about people's history of their relationships with nature and what influenced that. And for you both, that kind of combination of the urban context and how nature can be on your doorstep in central London, but also the wild spaces and the holiday vibes of a landscape like Purbeck. For people that have never heard of Purbeck and what the landscape constitutes, how would you describe it? What would you notice if you were part of that landscape?
Yeah, I mean, Purbeck is amazing. So it is one of the most biodiverse parts of the UK, primarily because it's got such a varied geology. So you have Poole Harbour, depending on how you define it, the second, third, fourth largest natural harbour in the world. You're surrounded by the sea on two locations. So you've got Studland and the sand dunes. You've got a chalk ridge that runs through the heart of Purbeck. You've got the Purbeck Heathlands. And you've got the South Purbeck limestone cliffs, which form part of the Jurassic Coast World Heritage Site. And importantly, the Purbeck never, because the land is relatively infertile, it never properly got put under the industrial farming. It did in parts, but not everywhere. So it has had, it probably is the most biodiverse part of the UK. Again, it depends how you define it, but also it should be because of the variety of habitats that should be there, if that makes sense. And crucially, what Purbeck has as a place, which is also important, is that you've had it being the heart of nature conservation in the UK. So you've had all the main NGOs and statutory bodies have been present for a while. And so you've got Natural England and its predecessors have been here since the 30s. You've had the National Trust here since the 70s. You've had the RSPB here since the 60s and so on and so forth. You've got the Forestry Commission have been here since the 1920s. So you've got some maturing relationships. And I think that's as important, certainly in terms of the groundswell for understanding why nature conservation is advancing here, is it's not just the physical assets, it's the people and the cultural assets that go through it. So that investment through various statutory bodies and NGOs. And when you come and visit, you have a variety of different experiences that are led by different organisations. So if one of those doesn't suit you, you know, if you go into the RSPB at Arne, is that focal point for the Purbeck Heath. If that doesn't grasp, you can go to the National Trust at Studland Bay, or you can go to Dilston Country Park, which is run by Dorset Council, or Kimmeridge, and go to a Dorset Wildlife Trust Centre. So there's enough different opportunities, I guess, to experience nature.
And what sort of scale are we talking about?
That is a really good question. So at Purbeck, we own about 15%. So we, being the National Trust, own about 15% of the Isle of Purbeck. Now, how you define that Isle of Purbeck is, we can go and have arguments about that. That's roughly 4,000 hectares. The important thing about Purbeck is it's defined. So you've got a supernational nature reserve, which was the first supernational nature reserve in the UK, which is the Purbeck Heath that I imagine you probably covered. So that's where you've had small national nature reserves in pockets that were de-declared. So there were three across the Purbeck Heaths, Studland Godlingston and Middle Beer and Heartland National Nature Reserves that were de-declared and formed into one big National Nature Reserve that was much bigger, as 3,500 hectares, that crucially encompasses private land within that. So there's now a massive landscape that connects across a 4-mile stretch of land around securing and managing this one contiguous landscape of heathlands that includes not just the usual suspects, as we would probably see, but crucially a private landowner. And this is where, I guess, importantly for you, it isn't just an NGO-led enterprise. We've got the Rempston Estate, led by Doug Ryder, who's bought their landholding into a protected landscape, which is where, for me, as somebody who's primarily worked in NGOs, it's really optimistic. That's where the future is. It's not just NGO-led. It can't be. So bigger, better, more and joined up.
I was going to talk about some of the experiences, so that if you haven't been to Purbeck, or maybe you have and you don't really know what you're looking at, I suppose, you know, if I was taking some friends over to Purbeck who haven't been before, they don't really know what they're looking at. They just know that it looks different to Bournemouth or Poole. But thinking that this is a landscape, you know, we've spent a lot of time mapping the assets, understanding what the experiences are. And you think, you could come to Purbeck and you could see snakes, lizards, puffins, eagles, beavers, butterflies. You can go picnic in meadows. You can go down to some of the most beautiful sheltered shallow beaches where there are seahorses. You know, you can go into woodlands of ancient trees. You can go and have incredible sunsets and sunrises. And you can do things like go on a bird boat in, you know, the world's second largest harbour and see marsh harriers and all the rest of it. You can also go and coast steer and climb off of the South Purbeck coast. Like, the breadth of experiences that you can have in a place that is primarily based outdoors. You know, there's no big soft play centres. There's no shopping centres. Most of the overnight stays are camping. It's all geared up to have that type of incredible experience. And that's why you get 4 million people coming to visit Purbeck every year, because you can come and have a different experience every time. And there aren't really many places that are going to be able to offer that breadth, awe and intensity of nature connection experience.
Now, you guys might not know, but we've been doing a lot of research behind the scenes about nature connection with what we're doing here at the Grange Project and beyond. Like Chloe says, I'm sold. You know, I want to get in a camper van and get across there as soon as we can. But I can only assume, having all of this nature on site and in the area, that the local population are embracing it and are, from a mental health perspective, surely glowing from all of this amazing abundance around them. Is that the case?
That's definitely the presumption when you're outside. And I've done lots of work, as you know, in different communities. And really, I suppose the thing to reflect is Purbeck's community aren't any more connected to nature as any other community in the UK. Now, that, on the one hand, it is quite depressing and quite stark, and is something for us to reflect on, that really you've got a massive societal issue. It doesn't matter where you are and what your natural assets are. Society isn't about structuring you, or isn't enabling people to connect with nature on any kind of meaningful level. And we can reflect that in different ways. We have worked hard to become trusted within the local community. That's something that both Alex and I have invested heavily in building links within schools, community organisations, community partnerships, working with other businesses and NGOs. And only once you've built that trust can you really understand what's going on, or you scratch beneath the surface and people will open up and trust you. And it was probably 3 or 4 years in that one of the governors at the local school in Swanage, which is a coastal town, was saying, well, children are starting school without even having been to the beach. And in high numbers, 40% of kids are starting school without ever having been to the beach. So if our view of being from outside Purbeck, or especially coming down from an urban area and experiencing on holidays, well, everybody's going to be doing this all of the time. They'll be coast steering. They'll be, you know, walking barefoot through the sand, skipping through the meadows, looking at butterflies and orchids. The reality is they're living the same lives that everybody else is, which is just, you know, a hard, hard time is precious. And that was really sobering, especially for me, who my experiences of coming into Purbeck were entirely positive. This Purbeck changed my life. and seeing that Purbeck was not changing the lives of people who lived here, or not benefiting the lives of people who lived here. You don't need everybody here to want to be David Attenborough, but this is a primary asset, the community's primary asset, that is not being used for the benefit of local people.
You know, you gave that example of these organisations have been there for decades. So what's gone wrong? I mean, I think that's not too strong a statement. What's gone wrong in that journey, do you think?
I mean, that's a really good question, isn't it? And you can reflect on it two ways. I guess we have, as a sector, the urgency back in the 60s and the 70s was around protection. And you know, certainly around the Heathlands, Heathlands were being built on. They were being planted up with conifers. They were being turned into farmland. The urgency was around protecting. So, you know, with the resources that people had, it was go in and protect these landscapes. What didn't happen was that wasn't a community-led approach. There wasn't a groundswell of the community that came in and wanted that to happen. It was a community of nature enthusiasts and through NGOs that came and did that. And at the time, I don't think the sector understood that there may be problems if you don't bring the community along with it, or didn't have the capacity to do so. You know, the sector is much bigger now than it was. So I don't want to damn the people that, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants in Purbeck, that without the work that's gone before, we wouldn't be able to do this. I think it's just recognising the problems of a fairly imperialist approach where you go in and you save land for nature on behalf of nature. But equally, Purbeck is just like anywhere else. You know, all the coastal communities have that presumption that you live in a coastal community, people are using the beach. They're not. It's the same in Bournemouth, Poole and Christchurch. So the expectation that Purbeck should be special because of these protected landscapes rather than just reflecting society everywhere else. And I think that's the sobering aspect for us as a national society is why should they? You know, people still have to live and work, and the systems by which we do that mean that, you know, we wake up in the morning, we drop our kids at breakfast club, we go and travel to work in our cars, wherever that work may be, and we come back and we pick our kids up from after school club, we do some homework, we feed them, we go to bed, and then what do? We get up and we're tired and we do it all again. Where's the opportunity in the way that we structure our lives to have that regular nature connection, whether you've got the assets there or not?
I think the other thing to reflect is how, society generally has shifted from where we would have been engaged, connected, working within outdoor areas, nature, etc., much more readily. Everyone would have, right? We would have had a much better natural rhythm and connection with just nature and the seasons and everything. And life isn't structured around nature and the seasons. Life is structured around the 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. And I think if you're looking at somewhere like Purbeck, where a couple of hundred years ago it would have been, you know, mining, fishing, quarrying, farming, those kind of jobs and careers. And now it's much more focused around care-based work, hospitality, tourism is huge, and there's a lot of seasonal work. So, and a lot of that is quite low paid. So you've got a completely different shift in what the jobs are. You've also got a high proportion of second homeowners. So there's the difference in how people are living from one end of the spectrum to the other is very stark compared to maybe other communities. And you add all of that together with everything that Thomas has mentioned around, you know, nature was being recovered for nature's sake and not bringing communities along with it. It's no wonder that there are communities and people, families that are not as connected to nature. And I think it's when you're looking at it in the context of this being one of the most biodiverse places in the UK, and everyone's telling us that if only you just had a bit more nature, if only it was a bit closer, you'd have better health and well-being, you'd be leading a better life and all the rest of it. And that's being proven, really, that isn't the main barrier living in Purbeck.
That was exactly what struck me, Alex. I was just thinking about if we can't achieve that in that such a biodiverse landscape, then where can we? Well, we, you know, in other contexts where you don't even have the nature or the natural spaces surrounding you. But I suppose that also presents this opportunity where you are to take advantage of that and explore all the multiple pathways there will be to enable people to both have time in nature and develop that nature connection associated with it. And I'm interested in thinking about the role of the NGOs. So obviously, historically, there was a role around protecting landscape and very much focused on the physical aspects of the land. But what role does the National Trust see themselves having now when it comes to thinking about engaging people and the community in the natural world?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, the National Trust is a radical organisation, certainly is at heart, isn't it? And maybe it lost its radical roots midway through and is kind of redefining it. So set up as an organisation to provide access to nature, beauty, history, the sky, sunset, space, nature for urban people. It was a response to the Industrial Revolution in that kind of late Victorian, fairly patrician ways. People are living very urban lives. How can we make them better? The National Trust was a response to that, as well as a lot of other organisations. And where we are now is we've, as an organisation, recognise that this is our call to action, and that can't just be through providing space for visitors. So the, you know, Purbeck, as Alex illustrated, 4 million visits to Purbeck each year, 1.5 million visits to Studland, which is our site. We do that really well, and for a wide demographic. You know, it's not just the preserve of the white middle class. Lots of different people are coming and visiting and extracting benefit from the landscapes. They're connecting with nature in their own terms, but recognising, if you go back to the primary focus of the audience of the existing of the proto National Trust, was on those people who were their lives had been diminished through the Industrial Revolution, living urban lives. Actually, fundamentally, that's pretty much everybody. That's who we all are now. We're all our lives are basically we're those factory workers who are waking up, working, waking up. If you're lucky, you get some sense of sunlight and you can have some sense of connection with nature within your daily lives. But you are the fortunate ones, and it's a luxury, not something that's written into your everyday life. And I guess where we've found our role in Purbeck is that the moral cause and the thing that nature needs. So there are two things: the people of Purbeck and the moral need is around ensuring that the community can benefit from our assets as a National Trust, but also its major asset, which is its natural environment, and looking at how we do that. But also from that longitudinal resilient nature recovery, that's only going to happen if it exists outside of NGOs and exists in that wider population. It can't be just wealthy landowners or NGOs. It can't just be the plaything of the wealthy middle class. It has to belong to everybody. And what's been really exciting in Purbeck is finding the mechanisms to make that relevant to everybody and build it into a community response.
And you mentioned that you wanted to ensure that people benefited from it and people, local people, benefited from it. What does that benefit look like? What does it tangibly look like?
I guess you've got two things: what the National Trust are doing, and then what is happening across the whole landscape with the whole community. And I think it was over the last however long we've been in post, 7-ish years, something like that, it's through listening to what the barriers are, how connected people are or not to nature, and who is and who isn't, and all the rest of it. It's and talking with that, you know, to for-profit businesses, and they're saying the same. Well, we're not really getting local people. We struggle to hire locally, and you're building up that picture, and everyone's saying, well, we all want to do something about this, but no one is really in the position to go, okay, I'm going to lead this. Something needs to be done, and we're going to convene everyone. We're going to bring everyone together. And so there was starting to emerge a real big gap, I suppose, within the community of, well, who is going to make this happen? Because at the moment we're all talking about things and maybe getting some funding to deliver nice projects and do some stuff, but no one is able to convene everyone and look at that long-term change, that systems-wide 20 years, you know, someone was born tomorrow, what would their lives look like in 20 years? What would we want them to have experienced in order to be able to get a job in the green nature outdoor sector, to be able to be as connected as possible to nature, and that really embed throughout their whole rest of their lives and their community? And so I guess we saw that as an opportunity, and we have invested in that from the National Trust perspective to be that person, that organisation, to lead the community through that. So what does that actually look like? We're trying an asset-based approach. So instead of looking at what the gaps are and trying to get funding to fund those specific things, we've invested our time to lead a community through that, convene, facilitate, support and champion. There's so many good things happening, and just to shine some light on the amazing things, and importantly, build relationships everything we're doing is around relationship building, because the stronger the relationships are between the schools, the activity providers, the landowners, the more commitment, the more accountability, the more everyone wants to do more. We're not necessarily looking at trying to do loads of extra activities that aren't already happening, but it's making sure that the schools, the teachers are aware of where they can go, what they can do, what experiences they can have with those students, making sure that that's enabled through some teacher training so that they know even the basics of why Purbeck's special, what experiences are there for them to go and see and experience, how can they write that into some of their curriculum, where can they go and have the school trips. And then there's also the career pathways. You know, we've worked really hard over the last couple of years to ensure that we can offer some really decent, good work experience opportunities. And a lot of the places that are offering them was they kind of weren't really getting much response, or they might get some students from elsewhere, or someone's got a grandparent living down here, so on their holiday from London, they'll come and do some work experience. Whereas now what we're doing is coordinating it all and building that awareness. So it's not necessarily a gap. There isn't a deficiency in experiences or school trips or work experience. What there is a deficiency in knowledge and bringing that together and I guess mobilizing everyone to look at what there is and really go for it. And I think it's championing and advocating that, so there's a constant, you could be doing this, it could be better, you know, let's shine a light on that. And off the back of that, we've been able to increase the amount of offers as well. So one of the for-profit businesses, Land Wave, has done some incredible work. One of the directors, Rosie, said last year to the network, I've got a vision that every kid in Purbeck is going to have a camp out, and they're going to have a night under the stars in a tent and do some amazing outdoor experiences, and we will do all of that at cost. And we'll do it all in September. And you know, I think everyone was like, well, this is incredible, how can we make it work? The time scales are really short, how are you going to mobilize all these schools to be able to make that happen? And she, you know, she was launching this in April this year for this September, and it just so happened in the network she was sat next to one of the local farmers who said, well, you could probably get some funding for that, and then was able to get funding from a farming and protected landscapes fund to fund all free school meal children who went on that trip, and they did the rest of it at cost. And they managed to make that happen for September with six schools.
Wow.
I don't know how that was even possible. If you're a teacher listening, you think, how on earth is that? Have they made that happen? But, you know, think of the amount of value that's added to the local community is so impressive. And to have a for-profit business standing up and doing something like that will only help secure more commitment from more organizations. And it's that convening and facilitating, enabling, leading, it's that role that the National Trust are playing, and that role which is crucial to making this happen elsewhere.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think there was definitely that pivotal point where, should we convene? Is that the role of the National Trust? You know, the National Trust is a big organisation. We're a big organisation in Purbeck, and we're a big national organisation. Is it our role to lead here? But if we don't, nobody else will. And it, in a community that doesn't have many leaders, right? Just being honest, that's not what it has in terms of people who see a vision, an optimistic vision of the future. Mm-hmm. I think that's also interesting. Maybe within rural communities, there aren't people who are going, I can see the future, come with me, this is going to be amazing. It's kind of almost like managed decline. There's loads of potholes. People just want to fill in some of those potholes, please. That's rather than, hang on, why do we should be envisaging a world with no potholes. We took a risk, I think, being prepared to take a risk to convene people and then to lead with a co-created vision that took 10 minutes for 20 organizations to come up with a vision, which is unusual in the NGO world. Usually it takes several years. But it's because everybody was on the same page. And that, you know, like Alex is saying, investing in those relationships, we're all naturally on the same page, right? Let's motor off into the distance. And the value of having Alex as an asset who everybody trusted to lead them through the process of creating a program, and this program to be only based upon what we already had. So this isn't about how we can all disappear off to get lottery funding. That's not what we as a community need. What we need to do is to extract the maximum benefit from what we already had. And it's optimistic. It's saying we have the solutions within the room. We just need to work out how we're going to distribute them to deliver our vision. And the work that Alex did through communicating that at within our local, there's a new local organisation called Planet Purbeck, a new grassroots environmental organisation that was set up in 2020 that, again, the National Trust helped to enable. We didn't lead, we enabled that to come into being. They have a celebration every year, a festival, and we launched the idea that we were going to develop this programme at the Planet Purbeck Festival in 2023, and we could come back in 2024 and say, we've developed this programme. All of these people in your community have come together to look at how we can improve the lives of local children, young people. And that's so powerful to show that this is a community response. We're doing that. And it's been a joy to, you know, be part of the visioning and part of the leading, but also then watching the enabling happening. And it, if you want to get technical, extracting the assets from the community and then distributing them. But really, it's just enabling people who want to give the mechanism to make a difference within their community. One of the big shifts that I saw being involved in a landscape recovery application, which is where landowners are coming together to look at a 20-year funding package for DEFRA. We went through an application process in this part of Purbeck and we weren't successful. But in doing that, we brought tenant farmers together. I think there were about 20 tenant farmers and they were pretty cynical. They weren't particularly optimistic, but talking to them, you know, watching their social standing diminish, watching their rural communities fragment. One of them was saying in the 1960s, his dad employed 20 people on the farm. It's now him and his boy and one contractor. You recognise that, you know, they're not that kind of capitalist drivers within the landscape anymore. People don't look to the farmers as being, they might still be upstanding members of the local community, but they're not fundamental because to that village, because most people in that village are commuting somewhere else to work economically. And one of our tenants had managed, his dad was the landlord of the local pub that had six darts teams. That pub doesn't exist, let alone the darts teams. And what we're talking about is like, well, we believe that we can put more jobs into the landscape through a nature-based economy. You know, if you look at the local activity providers that primarily provide for school trips that are coming down from urban areas across the southern half of the country, they employ, I think it's about 150 people within the landscape, and they're connecting people to nature in the landscape. Through nature recovery, there should be many more jobs in this landscape, and you're much more likely to be employed through the nature-based economy than you are in industrial agriculture. Industrial agriculture is amazing at stripping jobs from the landscape, ultimately. You know, some of the farmers are like, okay, I'm interested, but how are you going to do that in that kind of very gruff, challenging way? Well, actually, here's a community-led approach. This is what we're talking about. We've worked this through Purbeck Goes Wild, which Alex will talk about in detail, and giving them the mechanisms where they're like, oh, okay, I can see how this knits together. I can have not just my son mostly or my offspring employed within the landscape, but also my son or daughter, my offspring may want to stay because their mates are also employed, and there's life. You don't have to leave the rural area and go and do the urban or the London thing. You can stay here and have, as a young person, have that optimistic future of a well-paid job in Purbeck, but also your community still existing.
Both Alex and Todd, man, you said so much, and I'm going to try and reflect a bit back to you there because it was, I mean, pivotal. I had three or four points during that conversation, had little tingles go down my spine to hear what you were saying. So first of all, I think it's really interesting that continuity you were talking about and the fact that you, at the top of this conversation, you've both been in this for 7 years working for Purbeck. And I think that you people know you're going to be being around, you've built relationships, you hopefully will be around further going forward. And I think that's hugely beneficial. And also want to reflect just from talking to you both, your passion and clear ability to do it. You can just tell you speak to people that your systemic approach, your logical approach to problem solving, your entrepreneurialism, you go, well, okay, fine, there's a problem here, let's solve it then. Problems need to have someone that can just go, look, I'll hold this problem for you, don't worry, but I need your help as well. And that's what happened. And then my final thought was the power of citizens. And Chloe talks about, I've learned a lot from Chloe on this one, you know, her belief that we should all try and start becoming better citizens. And I think what you're empowering is here is better citizens. You're saying, look, okay, we'll take some of the load, but let's all be part of this solution here. And that's really exciting to hear going forward.
And that does actually connect on to the next question I have. And I was thinking, I think you referenced earlier, Tom, this idea of extracting benefit from the landscape. And I completely get that perspective. I think it's really critical that local people experience direct benefit from the landscape around them. But also what we know about nature connection is it's the reciprocal relationship about how people also get benefit from offering to the landscape, and that being rewarding on itself. When you feel like you're contributing to a community, when you feel like you're a good citizen, that has well-being benefits beyond, you know, perhaps going co-steering in a different way. And I wonder whether there is a kind of intention within Planet Purbeck and the wider National Trust position to also be thinking about how do people develop that reciprocal relationship.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, I guess we're still in that fundamental, how do we connect? And I know participation plays that role in connection and the wonderful feedback loop. So I think we're still in the infancy of that, to be honest. We're in the, well, you could come tree planting in a fairly traditional way. What would be lovely is in probably 5 years, 10 years down the road, is the community end up taking on stewardship, long-term stewardship, and taking on some of the visioning, I guess. We're a way off because the community isn't connected. So expecting that 0-60 thing to happen, that's not to diminish what's already happening, but it doesn't feel revolutionary in the way that, you know, the Purbeck Goes Well programme does around children, young people. One of the things we are putting in place around that citizenship is working within the year 10 and year 12 cohort at schools to build up environmental leadership. So the Leadership Skills Foundation have Environmental Leadership Award that they developed with WWF and the RSPB. And we've invested in a member of staff who's going in to lead that within the local secondary schools to build up that sense of leadership, not just custodianship, but it's leadership within the citizen space. Does that answer your question fully? It doesn't feel pioneering enough in that, to be honest.
But I think you're really right when you think about the stage that a movement is at. And I would say that what you know, you've talked about this being a movement, and that, you know, maybe I've got some questions about that later, but I think that definitely is recognising that you can't bring too much difference too quickly. You need to work with where people are at, hear them, meet their needs. And actually, if you want people to get a sense about what the benefits are to me of this place, then I will have a sense of connection to it that will then inspire more care. And that does take time. It's not going to happen overnight. When we think about trajectories of movements, we touched earlier at the start of the conversation about the role of young people and where young people are at in their relationship with nature at Purbeck. And I wonder what the National Trust has put in place to specifically address those needs.
So, I mean, a whole range of things, really. And it's not just through the National Trust, although it might be useful to start on some of the things that going through this process of setting up Purbeck Goes Wild and leading the network. It's then helps us reflect on, well, actually, are our own offers decent enough with our existing resource and staff capacity? And it's really helped us focus on what our offer is. So we now have the Environmental Leadership Awards set up. We've now got a youth club set up, all based around nature and the outdoors. We make sure that our work experience is decent. We also make much stronger connections with our local schools to enable them to have decent school trips. So our school's offer is much more focused. You know, we have a focus across the whole property of we want to invest any of our community work and a lot of our time and energy around local communities. But that's also helped enable what other organisations, the focus of what other organisations across the community and the network are also wanting to focus on as well. So they're looking at, well, who are we offering our work experience to? How do we make sure that those work experience placements are really filled properly? And talking earlier about the big Purbeck camp out with Land and Wave. And I think through everything, what this really offers is hope. And that's something that isn't seen a lot. And there are some other community movements going on within, especially around Swanage, that are not around nature and the environment, but around health and well-being, and forging ahead with that and leading the way for the rest of the UK, Swanage and Purbeck Development Trust, for example. But it really helps provide hope and inspiration, and really helping identify who are those anchor organisations who have now become those anchor organisations in the community that are people going to be looking to to say, well, what we're doing, is that good enough? Should we make that bigger and better? So we focus very much on not just what is available for young people, but what's around to support all of that for a young person. So if you think for a child, 70% of how connected a child is to nature is through directly from their parents or their main carers. And so you can't just focus on what the child, you know, what you can provide for the child. It has to be that whole cushioning effect of who comes to interact with that child. So schools, as well as parents and carers and the local community. So it's looking at everything around that. So we really are looking at nature-centered families and nature-centered schools to provide better nature connection for those young people. And through schools, we're looking at enabling more school trips in Purbeck, and better quality of those school trips. We're looking at career pathways. Like I mentioned, it might even be something as simple as assemblies within primary school. Just even, you know, a child will form their views on gender, jobs by seven. So unless we're starting early around what the opportunities are for jobs, you might have lost quite a few already by the time they get to secondary school. And then we're looking at families as well. So we bring together a newsletter every season, giving all the opportunities. It's really just information sharing. It's bringing together what's already out there. Events as well. One thing we have been able to do is through the existing assets of the network is if every organisation in that network, which is about 30, 35, could offer just one event for a year, you've suddenly got a suite of 35 events. You know, 5 years' time, we're hoping we won't even need events because there will be a transition between providing events for you to families self-organising and children being able to lead events and have more freedom to get outside. We also do some digital nature connection opportunities through the Wilder app and recently tested a different nature connection app. So there's all sorts of different opportunities, but it's really stepping outside of what can we provide for young people and looking at the whole system. What do we need to change in the whole system to in order those young people to feel more connected with nature?
It's been really interesting being here long enough as we talked about having that longevity. And we've put in free passes to go to Studland and to Corfe Castle in local schools. They weren't being used. So understanding that initial thing, especially as the National Trust, is the paywall an issue? Now, it may be for some, but actually it's not enough just to give free tickets because some people can't even afford the bus fare to get to the places. And even then, it's not something that's about me and about my relationship with my local space. And that's been really interesting by creating something that's speaking to local people called Purbeck Goes Wild and creating that local brand, because everything that's put out about the assets in the landscape is about visitors. So if you're living in a high tourism footfall area, all the comms, or the majority of the comms, is speaking to the visitor. It doesn't feel like it's for me. So, you know, we're starting that. And we, you know, collectively as a network, we understand that. It doesn't mean immediately by doing that you've solved the issue, but you're starting to get across that this is for you. You know, what we're doing collectively is for you. It's an opportunity. You don't have to take advantage of it, but we're focusing on you. And that overall aim, I guess, ultimately is building that resilience in the landscape. And this is about ultimately hopefully a nature-based economy that's rooted in local people and not people coming in from outside to extract value from a nature-rich landscape.
As we've been chatting, one of the things we're really interested here at the Grange Project is around how we create movements. And I've been trying to jot down some notes around what I think some of the ingredients have been that you've achieved at Purbeck. So you've talked about this co-designed, co-created vision, how that's then translated into a brand or a story of Purbeck Goes Wild or Planet Purbeck, how there's hope and it's focusing on strengths and resources. And then that translates into events where people can tangibly come together as a community, whether that's a festival or a camp out on the beach, that people can then have that lived experience. And it was making me think, really, first of all, how are you demonstrating the impact of all that you've achieved? And what can we be learning nationally from some of what you've achieved at Purbeck?
So I think that's a really interesting question around the evaluation. You know, how do we know that any of this is actually connecting more people to nature, pushing us any further along in terms of a theory of change or a systems-wide change? How do we know that this is actually doing any good? And I think when you're looking at the asset-based approach, the main marker for change or how you evaluate it is based on the strength of those relationships. So it's not around how many people turn up to things, how many events you put on. It's not the outputs. It's the outcome of the strength of a relationship. And it's through this process that we realize the networks are becoming actually one of the biggest and most important assets rather than an event or a workshop or whatever it might be. And we've, as a whole network, gone back and forth. Should we give out surveys to everyone who comes to an event? Should we survey the teachers? Should we look at how many events and try and do double the amount next year? And it's not, we keep coming back to the same thing. It's not because we don't want to do that or we don't see the benefit in doing all of that research. That will already be done to some extent elsewhere. What we know is that if you go and have an experience in nature, you're going to be connected with nature. We don't have to analyze that particular event or the experience because we know from previous research that's already been done that it will connect you with nature. So there has to be some level of assumption, because if you're looking at the amount of time and effort you're going to put into something, we decided it wouldn't be of benefit to the community or the program to spend it will be a fairly large proportion to evaluate that, when actually we need to be working on the strength of those relationships. Because all we know is that a 20-year program, 30-year program, that won't happen unless the relationships are built. And if you have relationships, you have commitment, you have accountability, change will happen. So that's where we've decided to focus our evaluation.
I would like to say, if there are any researchers out here who are particularly inspired and want to invest and want to come in and become an asset in Purbeck, that would be very welcome. But again, it's what assets do we have now? And researchers aren't one of them. And for us to spend a lot of time was felt not to be the best use of the asset at the time. And this goes back to the idea of the movement, doesn't it? The network and the movement and the momentum. And I mean, there's an amazing TED Talk. I saw it, I don't know, 10 years ago, Derek Sievers, about, sorry if I've mispronounced his name, How to Start a Movement. It's a 3-minute TED Talk. If you've never seen it on YouTube, it's will change the way you understand what we're doing. So first of all, you need somebody with a vision, somebody who's prepared to stand up. Now, that doesn't have to be you, but there needs to be that catalyst. And then crucially, you need people to support that. So those early adopters, and importantly, they're treated as equals. So it's not, in this case, we were the National Trust and we had the vision. We didn't then keep it as a National Trust thing. It's like, come on board. This is brilliant. We need your support and we're equals here. This is our thing. And I know Alex and I are, I suppose, the figureheads and prepared to talk about it in places like this, but there is a broad movement for this. And we met as equals and invested time in enabling those, anybody who comes into the movement, to understand what the movement is and understand what they can potentially do. So very much taking that enabling work. So being able to lead and enable have been something that certainly for me and Alex, we've really understood that that's what we need to do and really tried to work out, because they're very different spaces. There are a lot of environmental movements that are led by very charismatic figures, that if that charismatic figure finishes, you know, decides to go on to something else, dies, whatever, then it ends because there are no equals, because you've got the founder syndrome. We think we've built resilience into this so that if any one of us leads, it is a movement that will continue and perpetuate because enough people have taken a lead in their little part of the wider movement.
Guys, I think we're coming to the end of this conversation. This could have become a two-episoder very easily, and maybe we'll come back to finish off this conversation another time, maybe in a few years' time, where it's obviously evolved a little bit further. It would be wonderful. The other thing that I had when you were talking about supporting teachers and enabling them to be better at the kind of extracurricular, and I thought, as a teacher, I left military and became a computer science teacher, having someone there who says, don't worry, I'm going to help you. I'm going to provide the materials for you and enable you to do it is invaluable. And it won't happen without it. Not because teachers are lazy, but because teachers truly are overwhelmed with the amount of things they have to do beyond just the teaching. So thank you on behalf of teachers for doing what you're doing in that area. What we normally do is ask the guests to give some final thoughts. Now, I'm very well aware that Chloe asked two parts of the previous question. And I'd love to see if you would have any final reflections on what you can share with any other projects nationally, the things that you've learned that you think would be worth rounding up with.
So there's some key things to take away from Purbeck. is that if you want to connect people with nature, you can't just have lots of nature around them. You need an agent, a person that's going to do that, or an organization or somebody who's going to do that. It will not happen without. Purbeck is prime illustration. Secondly, for movements or for organizations that are serious about nature recovery, you need to invest in people who can influence other people or seek to influence other people within a community. And that's simply not how the sector is structured at the moment. Again, we can illustrate, I think, in Purbeck that we have amazing plans for what to do with the land for nature, but we've now matched that with as an ambitious vision for local people, as well as visitors, but the visitors are kind of taken care of anyway, for local, building a resilient community around a nature-based economy, and having that mobilises everybody. That's the true lubricant that will make this, make nature recovery stick. And that, for myself and Alex, but also the landscape around here and the landscape of nature conservation professionals, has been something that's truly exciting. So our counterparts within the Trust and Natural England are as excited about our vision for people as they are for vision for nature. And you cannot do that on 2 year. I cannot stress enough, you can't do that on 2 year funded projects. We've had the joy of me being core funded and Alex now being core funded by the National Trust in Purbeck because of the value that we bring. Too much of the sector doesn't value this enough and will value their interactions with their membership, who are already connected to nature, more than they will value the impact that connecting with new audiences is. And they will look to fund the latter through projects, and they will fund the talking to their existing core audience through core funding.
Alex, over to you for kind of any final reflections from your side.
But I mean, first of all, it's been an absolute privilege to work in Purbeck and to be able to lead this movement. There probably aren't that many opportunities in a career to do something this exciting and purposeful and innovative, I suppose, that has a true scaling effect. You could take this model to other areas and scale it up. So I suppose if you're listening to this and you're thinking, I'd love to be part of something like that in my own area, whether you are a leader, whether you know someone else who's interested in doing that or is already doing something, it's find those people, go where the energy is, find those people who are motivated, who want to make some change, who are community leaders, and join conversations. I can't overstate the importance of just lifting others. It might be joining conversations online, join LinkedIn. You know, me and Tom try and advocate as much as we can for other people on LinkedIn. It could be within a face-to-face community setting, but join a conversation, put yourself out there and start raising these conversations within your organizations as well. You know, we do that in Purbeck and help shape the strategy that launched this year of People and Nature Thriving. And I think it would be, if you're listening and you're interested, then don't underestimate the power you have to make some change.
I think that's a really lovely point to finish on, the idea of going with the energy. And I can really feel the energy that's come from you both and how that's catalyzed a community, and that will trickle across that whole landscape. So thank you so much for what you're doing, and thank you so much for sharing the story with us.
One of the things that really struck me from the interview and the conversation was the fact I had never heard of Purbeck. Had you ever heard of Purbeck?
Nope. Makes me think that I'm a very bad nature lover.
But it's interesting, isn't it? This is the jewel in of the UK's nature crown. It's a super national nature reserve. And yet, why hadn't that been part of any of our conversation, current knowledge, education?
Lexicon.
Yeah, the fact that we knew nothing about it. Maybe it suggests a bit about how much value is placed on natural spaces in general mainstream UK discussion.
I mean, there are 4 million people that do know about it. So, yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying. And, you know, part of me is thinking, well, okay, and that's my current thought process about that poor marketing or lack of kind of like broad marketing, and how do we sell these better as a place to be? But I think, to be fair, there's 4 million people a year go to this place. We're probably the ones to blame for not knowing about this place.
Yeah, maybe that's just more about our family's context and what was privileged in terms of our holiday destinations, etc. But yeah, it's just an interesting point of reflection.
But I am now left very inspired to go and visit Purbeck from all of Tom and Alex's descriptions of the landscape and what is possible to explore and engage with across the landscape there.
Mm. I just want to have my final reflection really on Tom and Alex's people, because I do think from that conversation and from previous ones, they do feel like a really special combination. It's like, how do we find people like that who are going to stay for 7 years in the same location plus and commit themselves passionately to improving that community? Not because it's a job, because you can tell when you talk to them, they're not doing it because it's a job. They're doing it because they truly believe in the value that they can bring to that community. So it left me wondering, you know, when we're looking at hiring people and bringing people into these roles, how do you test for the Tom and Alex effect? I'd love to know kind of what their interview process was to bring those two together, kind of kindred spirits in terms of what they're doing and their capability.
But I think the fact they have been there for 7 years before this sort of movement began to catalyze is really critical. And I think it's, for me, what's really lovely about this example is how it's something that's really grounded in place. Because I think if you're going to build trust, you have to have presence, and you have to have presence within a fairly limited geographical area, because if as soon as you get too big an area, you can't really have that presence. You can't build trust in the same way that you can have when you have face-to-face conversations with people, when you're there in the room, understanding what people need, what they want, what their hopes are, what they're inspired by. So I think for me, that was particularly hopeful about Purbeck as an example, is it is something that is truly grounded in place.
I also think I want to offer some appreciation to the National Trust. Well done for allowing, enabling Alex and Tom to come up with these ideas and to back them, say, all right, well, this is not our normal wheelhouse, but actually we could do this. You know, you show us that if this can be successful, and maybe this becomes a blueprint for the future for other projects. And I think, you know, fair play, it takes some leadership and strategy or very charismatic people to convince leadership that it's a good idea.
And I would love to hear about any other examples across the UK of people doing similar things. We were actually emailed by a lady called Victoria from Be Wild in Dartmoor, which is a slightly similar project with a similar intention around community and engaging businesses and local people in Dartmoor becoming a kind of nature community or town. And I think like those sorts of examples bring me so much joy and hope. And I would love to hear more.
So this is getting into the realms of the Hall of Fame for becoming one of the longest episodes. But again, I think a good one and well worth the listening time. So I think we should close out right now. It is, you know, the festive time of the year. And if you do want to get, you know, listener, dear listener, Chloe and I a present, then what you could do is just stop what you're doing now. Just go onto your whatever podcasting device you listen to, Spotify, iTunes, and just leave us a rate and review. And that, we say it every single time, but that really does make a fantastic difference to our listener base, but also builds confidence in other people finding the Wilder podcast. And hopefully if it helps you, it's going to help them as well. What's the Welsh for Merry Christmas?
Nadoileg, Nadoileg Glawan. Nadoileg, Nadoileg Glawan.
I'm so sorry for native Welsh speakers.
We're trying.